Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 24th, 2013. The terrible news from Moore, Oklahoma this week brings up all kinds of questions. How do you recover from a disaster that in a split second takes everything that you own? How do you rebuild? And where do you get the money to get started? Many of the people affected by the tornado that struck Moore were insured, but that doesn't mean they can expect a check that'll just make everything all right. In our hearts, we know this. There's some damage money can never fix. But on the very practical side, that insurance check may not be enough to rebuild the house that they lost. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that insurance companies have been battered by a series of these natural disasters, and they've responded by capping our payouts and hiking our deductibles. That means some people and more may have to pay the first $1,000 of any claim they file. So now I've asked Logan Layden to join us to give us a sense of how people are coping with those insurance claims. He's a reporter with the State Impact Project in Norman, Oklahoma, about 10 miles from the city of Moore. Hi, Logan.
Hello.
So what's it like there in Moore now?
Well, you know, the first time I went there was on Monday evening, just a few hours after the storm, and just kind of drove through, and it was utter devastation. Of, you know, the long, difficult process of cleaning this whole mess up is well underway. Streets have started to be cleared, things like that, roadblocks taken down. So we're starting to see the process move along a little bit of people trying to get their lives back together.
And how are people doing that? I mean, how do you even start in a case like this?
Well, you really kind of have to start by going to your insurance company. That's where I ran into a lady, Jeannie Lawley, on Wednesday morning. They've got this big group of tents set up there at the First Baptist Church in Moore, trying to help people get their claims expedited more quickly. You see these images on TV, and they're very powerful. But when you actually get down there on the ground and you talk to the people, it makes it so much more difficult.
Frustrated at all, or is it going pretty smooth?
No, we appreciate the help. We lost everything.
The whole
vehicles, everything.
So whenever, you know, you ask someone a couple of questions and they start to cry, you know, it's upsetting, and it makes you wonder, you know, how difficult is it for her to have to talk to the insurance company about these things and go into great detail about all the things that she's lost. So,
and do you have a sense of how people are handling it?
Yeah, you really do. You see a lot of people, you know, everybody understands that it's important, even though you're dealing with a disaster that's cost you a lot of property, maybe even lives, that there's important work still to be done. And if you want to get the full amount of help that you feel like you deserve, then you've got to get right on that immediately. And this was, you know, like I said, we were up there on a Wednesday morning. This is less than 48 hours after the event. And even by that time, I think there had been something like 2,700 people who had filed claims just by, and I was there at 9 a.m. So, you know, people are really, they understand what they need to do. And this is a strong community. This is something that Moore has dealt with in the past. And so there's a lot of experience with it.
Now, do you have any idea what percentage of people in Moore have insurance that covered this damage?
Well, not specifically in Moore, but from what I understand, most people do have homeowners insurance. I think it's somewhere in the 90%. There's a few exceptions, older homes, things like that. Mainly, though, if you're going to take out a mortgage, you're going to get a house financed through a bank. That bank is going to want to see some proof of insurance. Now, if you don't need to borrow any money to buy a house and you can do it all on your own, then there's no law saying that you have to have homeowners insurance, but most people do, and I would say probably especially in Moore, given the fact that this is not out of the question from happening.
Now, do you need special tornado insurance in a place like Moore?
Usually not. From what I understand, tornadoes covered by the wind damage clause that are in most of them. So generally no. But it's still, you know, a huge hassle for these people who are trying to deal with the fact that they've lost everything, you know, to have to now worry about making an inventory of the things that they owned and talking in great detail to adjusters about it.
Now, how quickly are people going to get paid?
Well, you know, I actually, on Wednesday morning, I talked to John Wiskover. He's with Oklahoma Farm Bureau Insurance Company here in Oklahoma. And he says this idea that it takes a really long time to settle these claims is not true.
There's a misconception. If you've had a total loss, you may be weeks or months before that settlement's. In fact, we've already made settlements and had that contact.
So basically he's saying that it doesn't take as long as you might think to get these things settled. And in fact, even just like I said, a few hours after the storm, they had already settled several cases as far as getting money to people.
Now, once people get these checks, do you have a sense if they're going to rebuild there and more, or are they going to look somewhere else?
Well, you know, that'll be an individual case. You know, just watching the news and talking to the people there on the ground, you hear some stories of people saying, you know, we had planned on moving and now we're going to move sooner. But really the sense from most people is that they're going to rebuild. They have a really nice movie theater there in Moore that's kind of a big attraction for the area that was severely damaged in the storm. Yeah, so there's a lot of resolve. There's a big sense of community, and I think they'll rebuild just as they did in 1999 when a similar storm caused great devastation in the town.
And what's the next immediate step for folks who've lost everything?
Well, a lot of people, the first thing that they need to do is find food, water, and shelter, things like that.
The basics.
Yeah, absolutely. But a few days in, you know, even FEMA is pretty clear about the fact that they would like, when you come to apply for aid with them, they want to see proof of that you filed insurance claim if you've had insurance. So there's a process to this. You know, it's not just a spigot that gets turned on or a check that's written to you. You've got to do the hard work of doing these inventories and talking to an adjuster and getting your claim at least filed and then going over to FEMA, filing a claim there for whatever other assistance that you feel like you need. Then you're going to have a visit from an insurance adjuster to the property and then from FEMA as well. So it's a lot to have to deal with. But those steps are happening right now, right up the street there in Moore, where this parking lot of this First Baptist Church has really been turned into kind of a insurance city. All the major carriers are there. So it's supposed to kind of be a one-stop shop for anyone that needs to do these things.
What's this been like for you? How's covering this story been for you?
Dealing with these disasters, with the loss of life and property like this, you know, like I said, when I drove over there on Monday night, I'd never really seen anything like that before. And to see it with your own eyes and to smell the gas in the air and stuff, it's just, you know, I went and saw Star Trek at that movie theater last week, and to drive by it a few days later and see it all dark and devastated is, you know, it's upsetting.
Logan Layden is with State Impact Oklahoma. Thanks, Logan.
Thank you.
In Moore, Oklahoma, are thinking about rebuilding and pretty much starting over. Folks who live in Joplin, Missouri are marking the second anniversary of the tornado there that killed 161 people. The town's been rebuilding its physical structures and its community. Joining us now is Mark Rohr. He's the city manager for the city of Joplin, Missouri. Mark, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So I understand you all are helping out in Moore, Oklahoma. What are you actually doing there?
Well, we sent a response team over that first night. We had 10 police officers and 4 firefighters that went over and tried to provide assistance and be of some help. And I gave one of the police officers a copy of a book I had written about of our experiences following the first 6 months after the storm. And there's a page in the back that summarizes what we call the 10 tenets of disaster management. And we realized they don't have time to read a book at this point, but we thought that summary could provide them some assistance based on our experiences. And we asked one of their police officers to provide that to the city manager, and hopefully that could provide some level of help and assistance in dealing with what they're faced with at this point in time.
Now, what's their very next step? Where do they go from today?
Well, I don't want to presume to make decisions or know what they're going through in every instance. I can just call attention to what we did. The first thing we tried to do was clear the streets. So that opens all the doors for all the other things to take place, and they may have accomplished that by this point in time. I have to clear the drainage ditches to make sure that you don't compound things by having stormwater build back up. You have to complete your search and rescue efforts, which I think they've done, and start making plans. You have to remove the debris. There's an incredible amount of debris that we experienced, 3 million cubic yards of debris, and I'm sure they've got a lot to contend with there, so they've got to start making plans to do that. And all the while, they'll have people there from FEMA and other agencies helping them through this. But it's a daunting task.
And where do you begin with the rebuilding process?
What we did is we had a lot of people that wanted to rebuild quickly and get started, and we actually put a moratorium on rebuilding and as far as residential construction was concerned. And we did that mainly because we had to get the debris out. We had a deadline to get that out. So we began rebuilding by delaying rebuilding, if that sounds it sounds illogical, but that's in effect what we did. And that also gave us a little bit of time to plan the debris removal, and also gave council time to sit down and talk about some changes that they might want to make to the building codes and other codes to allow us to build back better than we were before the storm.
So tell me, what's the city of Joplin like today, 2 years later?
We had 7,500 homes impacted by our tornado, and 84% of those homes are now rebuilt, repaired, or have building permits in place to do so.
Wow.
And then we had about 550 businesses impacted, and 90% of those businesses are either up and running or will be so in the very near future. So we've come a long way in a short amount of time.
And what about the community? How has it rebuilt itself?
I think it's drawn it closer together. That would be my assessment. Going through an experience like that gives you a common bond, and we've tried to build on that common bond. And we've tried to draw the community together based on our experiences, because we knew, number one, we had to do that to get through what we were going through, and number two, that we knew that we had a lot of work to do and that we needed to work together to get that work accomplished. So as far as Joplin is concerned, I think it brought us together.
Joplin, Missouri City Manager Mark Rohr, thanks.
Thank you.
A new six-month-old son. His name is Asa. And the idea that one day he could be grown enough to be out of my house is kind of unfathomable. Like, I'm going to start crying just talking about it. It makes me that sad. But I know logically and rationally that one day he's going to have to go. Like, one day I'm going to want to push him out of the nest because he needs to be an adult. He needs to be a grown-up. And that happens with adult children. You want to launch them into the world. But right now, a whole lot of kids are staying at home. And so today we're going to talk about why there are so many adult kids still there. Joining us now to help discuss it is Michelle Singletary. She's a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
So the census tells us that there are more than 22 million adult children still living at home with their parents, which is a number that's way up over the last decade. Why so many?
Well, I think a combination of things. People are coming out of college. They don't get the jobs that they expect, paying the money that they need or want. Lots of kids are not going to school because it is so expensive. I mean, right now, to launch yourself, it's very expensive to get the down payment for the apartment and transportation and all the things that you have to do. And so that's why a lot of young adults are at home or returning home.
And what really does it take, if you were to break it down, what does it take to launch out into the real world?
Well, from my perspective, I think that they ought to have a really good emergency fund that will tide them over for at least 6 months while they're sort of getting themselves situated. And that would include all that it costs to run their household, not just the rent or mortgage, transportation, food, utilities, that cell phone that they can't part with, and probably the student debt that they're carrying, all of that. And to have a really good cushion. And in addition to that, I advise people to have what I call a life happens fund. And that's for when things in life happen.
Just go wrong. Yeah,
that's right. Things go wrong. And you want to have a cushion so that you don't touch your emergency fund while you're taking care of the things in life that happen.
Now, I know you have your personal experience with this, and I want to ask you about that later. But first, let me introduce you to Carl Orense. He's 20 years old. He lives here in Los Angeles. He has a full-time part-time job as a certified nursing assistant. Carl, hi.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about your living situation right now.
Well, right now I live with my dad. I lost a job, so I was forced to move back in with him. So tell me
about living with your dad. What's it like?
Yeah, I live with my dad, my stepmom, and my half-sister. There's some benefits to it, I guess. My benefits mainly are that I don't pay rent for now. And most of the money that I do earn working as a CNA mostly goes to me and my hobbies or my needs.
And so what are those hobbies and needs? How do you spend the money that you earn?
Well, needs like cell phone and then... Well, that's actually like the only needs I have.
The only real need is that phone.
Because like food is free at my dad's house, yeah.
And so tell me about when you're living at your dad's, where do you sleep? What kind of space do you have that's your own space?
Actually, I'm kind of embarrassed to say, but the apartment's only a two-bedroom, one bath. And I live in the living room.
You live in the living room?
Yeah.
And so you said it was a little embarrassing. Why?
Oh, you know, I'm 20 years old, you know. I'm supposed to be trying to get my independence now. So, you know, like it's just that you still live with your parents kind of thing.
And so, Michelle, jump in any time here, but what should Carl, as he's thinking about moving on, what should he be thinking about?
Well, he should have a plan, and he sounds like he has loosely a plan.
Yeah, it's a loose plan, honestly.
Yeah, I'd like you to do more budgeting. Like, you kind of glossed over the numbers. So how much are you bringing home, would you say, on a weekly or monthly basis?
On a monthly basis, with one job, I bring home about $1,200.
Okay.
That's already with the tax taken off.
So that's net.
That's net.
Right. And how much of that are you saving to move out?
Well, right now, I'm not really saving much to move out. It's because I'm in the process of buying my own car first.
Okay. Right now, you have a bicycle. Is that right?
Yeah, right now, I just bike around.
Right,
When it's raining. Oh, my God. The other day, I had to, like, bike in the rain going home.
But you see where I'm getting, Carl. You know, you got to take that $1,200. So you're allotting some for the car. And then how much of the rest of it are you putting towards actually moving out?
I'm just saving about like $100 a month. Definitely for like moving out. It's like it's not going to happen anytime soon yet. But maybe give it like about 6 months to a year before I move out.
Now, what about your parents? Are they asking you to chip in? Do you chip in for food or rent, anything like that?
Well, I've asked my dad for a favor to not charge me for rent yet because he's already starting to think about like charging me for rent. So
is he ready for you to be out of the house?
Oh, he's been ready.
So, Carl, what I think you could do to head that off, because I don't think he should charge you right now unless you plan on setting up shop in his house for a while.
No.
But why don't you come up with a plan, put it on paper, and say, Dad and Mom, this is my plan. I'm paying off the car so I have transportation. And for the next 6 to 8 months, I'm going to save about, you know, 95% of my take-home pay to build up a down payment and emergency fund. And when I reach that, then I'll be ready to launch. And is that okay with you? Because my plan is to do that. I can't do that if I have to pay you rent. And if you put it on paper and show it and let them know that you have a plan and show them the statements, the bank statements that you're building up that money, I think they might pull back and not hassle you so much right now.
Yeah.
Do you think they'd do that?
My dad's a understanding guy, so he'll probably go with it also.
Yeah, and if it's not, tell him, you know, give me a call. I'll talk to him. Because I'm not one of these people that think that you ought to shove a young adult out right away. It used to be that young adults stayed in the family home really until they got married and they were well established.
Yeah.
And so you're young, you're starting off. Where would you have gotten the money to move out on your own? I think it's perfectly okay right now because you have a plan. Now, if you were just laying around and not really doing anything, then I'm like, you got to go. But that's not the case with you. You've gotten some experience. You've gotten, some training. And so you are on the path. So I think if you, like I said, if you show them where you're going, they're likely to go along with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Kyle, this means no eating out with the friends.
I love Korean barbecue, so.
Make it yourself at the house.
So the cell phone you're okay with, though, Michelle? You can keep the cell phone?
If I try to pull that out of his hand, you know,
what is the say? Like, texting my friends, like,
you know, cold, dead hands. It's not going to happen. So, you know, I'm going to let him have the cell phone, but everything else got to get cut.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah,
we appreciate
thank you for
it.
Me.
If you have questions or comments, you can find us online. We're at marketplacemoney.org. We're also on Facebook. And coming up, we're going to talk about the cost of having an adult child at home when you're the parent and maybe how to encourage them out when it's time. Stay with us. We're talking about adult children living at home, and we've got Washington Post's Michelle Singletary with us. Michelle, I've got another question for you.
Sure.
So this one comes from a listener from Facebook. His name is Thomas Amendola, and he wrote in, he actually has a good-paying IT job. He's in New Jersey. He makes somewhere in the range of $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And he has decided to live at home to save money to buy a house. So he's saving $18,000 a year to buy a home. And I wondered what you made of that and what you made of his parents deciding it was okay.
You know, if his parents are in agreement and they're getting along, I think that's a great idea. Because think about that. If he saves enough, and I would save enough to put, you know, a huge down payment to almost paying the house off, and he's not coming back after that. I'm a different kind of parent. I'm not one of these that, oh, they've got to be on their own. You know, I believe that I have a home. I have people come stay with me while they get themselves together. And I'm okay with that as long as they have a plan. And he has a really good plan.
Now, I saw a study from the National Endowment for Financial Education that said about a quarter of parents with adult kids at home actually go into debt while they're having their kids at home. And it does sound like this is a situation that can put a big financial strain on parents. How does that work and how do you negotiate it as a parent?
Well, there's lots of adults who come home and there's not a plan. They just come home and they use up their salary. They're going out with their friends. They're still shopping. All the bad habits that they had out on their own, they bring right back to the house. Right. And the parents are afraid to say anything. They don't charge them rent. And that's when they have trouble and they go into debt because they're still subsidizing that adult child. I have parents, you know, who are paying the cell phone bill for their adult child who has a job.
Wow.
That's not the situation I'm talking about. If you've got a trifling adult child at your house, who's not doing all the right moves.
Kick him out.
Kick him out.
Well, I want to bring in our next caller right now. His name is Daryl Meekins. He lives in Halsey, Oregon. Two of his adult children are at home. Daryl, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about your situation.
I have my youngest who has pretty much continuously lived at home. He moved out for a short time.
How old is he?
He's 23.
Okay.
I think. I've got seven. They all blend together. And then I have another child that was out on his own for a long time, but had an accident and now is handicapped. But he went to college and got a degree. And I told the kids that I can't help them financially much when they go to college. So my way of helping them is to allow them to move back home so they get free room and board.
Now, so you have two adult children at home right now. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how does it affect your family and your finances?
Profoundly.
What do you mean?
Well, there's a constant outgo. My oldest has graduated from college, but he hasn't found employment yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's ongoing expenses there. There's expenses that occur every month, but then there's occasional expenses that are pretty high. For instance, he needed some legal assistance a while back, and so I took out a loan for that. And he's attempted to pay me back as best he can, but without work, you know, he can't. Eventually, I have no doubt that he will eventually, but it just makes it difficult. Probably on a monthly basis, I'd say an extra $400 to $600 a month for utilities and food and transportation
And are your children helping you out at all? Do they help pay any of these bills?
They help as they can. My youngest just got a job, and he's starting to pay his out-of-pocket expenses, his insurance and gas and those things. So that takes quite a load off. He hasn't started to buy food yet, but he doesn't eat much. So, but he does help out around the house, and even though I think it would be good for my kids to be on their own, I will miss their help when they leave, but that's, you know, a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
So are you and your wife ready for them to be out on their own?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have been for some time. Actually, we had about 6 months when all of our kids were gone and on their own and doing well, and we got over the empty nest syndrome pretty quickly and learned to enjoy our time together. And my wife really enjoys having her private space, you know, her kitchen to herself and the run of the house and so on. And we miss that. So we're anxious for them to get on their own. But we're not so anxious that we want them to leave before, you know, circumstances are good for them.
And so does it cause stress in the family? Do you and your wife fight about it ever? Do you and your kids fight about the situation ever?
Occasionally, but most of the time it's not the kind of thing we fight about. We're a pretty close family, but there is a level of stress that attends when you want to go in the front room and after a hard day at work and sit down and watch a TV show while you eat dinner and that sort of thing. Then you've got to negotiate, well, this show will be over in half an hour. Can you come back then? And, you know, that sort of thing.
Now, when you think about the last 39 years of having children, it's a big number when you add up the costs of having that many kids, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think I could even come close. Yeah. I read the studies where they show that, you know, it costs $250,000 to raise a child. And I look back at the money I've earned and I think I spent more than I've earned.
Really?
It seems. We don't have a lot in assets at this point. Our house is about it.
Oh, Michelle.
Yeah, that concerns me because you really need to focus on building your retirement and what's going to happen once you and your wife, if you're working, stop working. And it sounds like you've focused so much on launching the children that you've forgotten yourself. And the problem is, if they're still sort of getting themselves situated and it comes time for you to retire, what will you do then? And if you have all your assets tied up in your house, how are you going to have the money that you need for medicine and health care and all those kinds of things? So I need you to switch gears a little bit, not a little bit, but a lot, to focus on yourself as well. And it's not selfish. I see a parent, two parents who have been unselfishly about their children, but I need you to be a little bit selfish right now and really kind of focus on getting your resources stocked up for when you retire. Otherwise, you're going to be going living with them, and you don't want that.
That's our joke, that when we retire, we'll just move in with the kids. They can pay us back.
Except they're going to give you the back room with the TV that doesn't half work.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much for chatting with us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Daryl Meekins is a father of seven from Halsey, Oregon. Now, Michelle, you have been patiently giving us your advice, giving us your good thoughts. But I understand that you've actually lived this yourself.
I did. My sister came to with me with her daughter and my nephew. So he's about 18 years old. I didn't know he was coming with the package deal, but that's okay. Yeah, I knew my sister and my niece were coming, and then all of a sudden my nephew, I was like, why do you have a bag? You know? And so he ended up staying with us for about a year. And, you know, he didn't really have a plan, and he didn't know what he wanted to do. So he would get up in the morning and open the newspaper, and for about an hour or two, look through the want-ads and decided that he'd look for a job, and there weren't any jobs.
And that was it.
So that wasn't going to fly with me. So after about a week, I said, okay, well, you now owe me rent every month. And he's like, well, I don't have a job. How do I owe you rent? Welcome to the real world. And I did that to motivate him. Had he had a job, I probably wouldn't have done that. So then after about 2 or 3 months, he owed me 3 months worth of rent, and he quickly realized I was not playing. And so he seriously looked for a job, got a job. Then we started to add in the cost for utilities. Then we started to add in the cost for food because I wanted to simulate for him what it would be like in the real world without his auntie helping him out.
So you just ramped up those costs.
I did, and I based it on percentages because you spend about a third of your net income in housing. So I knew what he made because you have to show me everything. When you live in my house and as an adult, I need to know what you make. I need to know what's in your savings account. I need to know everything. So I knew what he made. I charged him a third. Then I added in what a percentage for utilities and then food. And I'll never forget, when I told him he had to start helping towards food, he says, "What? That's not included in my rent?" And I said, "Well, you know, when you move out an apartment, why don't you go down to the apartment manager and ask when he's going to deliver your bag of groceries and see what happens?" Oh, I'll back up and tell you this really quick story. So one month he came and gave me his rent in cash, and he was a dollar short.
$1.
And I'm counting my rent, you know, because I count my money. And I said, "Where's my dollar?" And he says, "Oh, I can't believe you're going to try to get me to pay your dollar." And I said, "You better go get me my dollar." And this is why I did that. Because if you pay your rent or mortgage late and short, it's as if you didn't pay it, and you're still going to be charged a late fee. And I wanted to drive home that message to him.
Now, did he get your dollar to you?
He got my dollar. He found pennies and quarters somewhere, and I told him, "Don't look at my cushion." But he gave me and he brought me my dollar. He did.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for all the good advice.
You're so welcome. If I could just say one quick thing, you know, I know that it's in this economy, there are lots of adult children returning home, and it's very stressful. And some parents feel like they've been a failure because their kid's not out on their own. But I don't think you should feel that way. And even if they come back in their 30s and 40s, you know, just look at it as that you're just helping them. And I do believe to whom much is given, much is required. And it's okay as long as you communicate and have a plan.
Michelle Singletary is the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. This week on the show, we're talking about taking control of your money, deciding that you're really going to get serious about it, that you're going to do this by yourself on your own. But a lot of times, taking control actually means asking for some help, like hiring a financial planner. But when does it make sense? And when is it best just to decide, nope, I've got this one, it's on me? Well, we've got Erica Sandberg with us for a little Financial Planner 101. She's editor-at-large for Bankrate.com's Credit Card Guide. Hey, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So we posted this question on Facebook. We asked people, what questions do they have about financial planners? And we have been flooded with responses. And so now I'm going to flood you with questions.
Flood away.
We'll start with the most basic. Brian wrote in to ask, when should I consider hiring a financial planner?
If you've got a lot of questions and you really need someone to help you develop a plan and just kind of a path to get to where you want to go, financial planners are terrific. That's what they're there for.
Now, are there little flags that come up that maybe should send me to a financial planner?
Oh, absolutely. If you don't have a will, if you've got some cash that you want to give over to your children, really a financial planner is going to be there for you. You also are going to want to have some really good, solid advice regarding insurance, tax planning, investment advice. And that's what a financial planner does. You could be the smartest person in the world, but, you know, come on, get some guidance from people who are trained in it.
Now, Kate online asks, does it make sense for someone with lower income to hire a financial planner?
Great question, Kate. And I'm going to say it depends. And I hate that response, but I'm going to say that only because, look, if you're financially strapped and you really don't have cash, for goodness sakes, go do it on your own. Get as much information as you can from really reputable sources for free.
Now, how can you decide if it's actually worth it to go get that financial planner?
Well, if you've got a little extra cash, you want something very specific to your situation. So, for example, you're going to throw at them everything having to do with your assets and your income.
So my bank account is this much. This is
yes.
what I want. This is what I want for my child. This is what I want for my retirement. All of that stuff.
You got it. And then what you're going to leave there with, let's just say it's a fee-based and you're just going to get this plan that's developed for you. You're going to have a kind of a good, solid plan that's made up for your situation. And then it's just, it's a roadmap. And sometimes they set it up for you too. So
another question we got online from Irwin is, how do you find one you can actually trust with your money?
A little bit of research. You know, I would not go with just the first one and say, oh, okay, well, that's, you know, that's who I have. You know, talk to a few. It's personality driven. But how often is it that we go to somebody, I don't care who it is, and they just kind of throw you into what they think is right? You really, really need to have somebody who listens to you, Erwin, and who says, okay, I get it. This is what you're saying to me. This is where I want you to go. This is how I can help you. And if they're not saying that, walk away. There's a million. There are so many financial planners out there.
Now, what about how they get paid? I mean, how do you decide if they actually have your best interests at heart?
A lot of times it really comes down to consultations. There is a big difference between fee-based and whether they're commission-based. Generally speaking, a fee-based financial planner is the way to go, but not always, generally.
Now, we hear a lot about going with fee-based financial planners, and there's a sense that maybe commission-based financial planners are on the dark side of the financial planner sphere. Why would it ever make sense to go with a commission-based planner?
Well, I'm going to get a lot of hate mail about that. Yeah, I mean, if I just... I have friends who are financial planners who are, you know, they get paid on commission, so they represent an insurance company or an investment firm, and so they're going to present those as your option. So there is a slight bias. A fee-based is hourly, just like you would pay an attorney. It's just more neutral. But, you know, everybody's got a bias when you think about it, right? We all have something that we think, oh, it's just wonderful, or maybe we've got a cousin who works there, whatever the case. So I typically do like the fee-based financial planners just because it's just a little bit more broad.
And then the question on everybody's mind, on all of our listeners' minds right now, what's this actually going to cost me?
Yeah, you know, a newbie who's out there, the financial planner, they just got their CFP credentials. You know, they could charge as $100 an hour.
Okay.
But, you know, it could go up to $200, could go up to more.
Erica Sandberg is the author of Expecting Money, The Essential Financial Plan for New and Growing Families. Thanks, Erica.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Now we've got Luis Barajas with us. He's one of our favorite certified financial planners. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be back.
So, Luis, we've got a listener on the phone for you who I know really, really wants your expert advice. But before we get there, I know you want to clarify one thing about financial planners.
Well, there's a huge misconception of how people get paid. There's commission, mm-hmm. then there's fee-based. Fee-based people actually can charge you a fee, but also sell product.
Ah.
There's a higher level, which is called fee-only. They cannot earn a commission, nor can they accept referral fees. Now, the other thing is when you have fee only, you kind of let your licenses that to sell go.
Okay.
And so what happens is by law, fee only advisors have a fiduciary responsibility with the individual they're working with. Commission and fee-based actually have licenses with some kind of broker. And so their fiduciary responsibility is with that broker, not with you.
Now, does that mean that I should look for a fee-only certified financial planner?
Absolutely. I think that what you're looking for is someone that's going to remove all conflict of interest, has your best interests at heart. And then if they're going to select investments for you and help you, they're going to walk you through either through a Vanguard or DFA, something that's no commission. Or if they're going to refer you to an estate planning attorney because you need to get a will or a trust done, they're not going to send it to their best friend who's going to give them a cut or take them
right.
out to play golf or whatever, can't receive a referral fee.
Great. Well, you're actually here to answer a different question.
Okay.
One we have from a caller. We've got Maria on the line from Minneapolis. Hey, Maria.
Hello.
So have you actually thawed out there in Minnesota yet?
Yes, we have finally, but it got cold again. But we did have snow on May 3rd.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Well, congratulations. Welcome to spring.
Well, thank you.
So can you tell Luis a little about your situation?
The situation is that after over 6 years of un and underemployment, I am gainfully employed as a project manager for a research study at the University of Minnesota.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm actually working full time again. I'm very excited.
You sound emotional. You sound emotional about this.
Yes. Of course. Sorry.
No, please. Congratulations.
Those are happy feelings.
It's happy
those
feelings.
Are happy feelings. I'm
going
to get emotional
for you.
Listening to you right now, Maria.
Well, being unemployed is really, really difficult.
Absolutely.
And during my unemployment, this leads up to my question, is that during my unemployment, I ended up losing everything. I lost a house and foreclosed on that, and I lost my entire retirement savings because I needed to cash it in to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I am now, back in a professional job, and I mean, first of all, I suddenly feel like I have this largesse. I suddenly have more than enough money. My expenses are low. I no longer have any, I have no debt. My credit rating is back up into the 700s. And I could actually work out a budget where I could save like a third of my income, although I would also like to have some money for pleasure too. I'm grossing about $1,700 a month.
And so the question is just how much should you save and how much should you feel free to do something fun with?
Yeah, and how do I save?
Right. Well, Maria, first of all, congratulations. And the most important thing to do right now is to focus on building a safety net for yourself. You're going to have to build an emergency reserve, or what I call a confidence fund. The other thing is also you want to start, because you've used up all your money in your retirement plan, is figuring out as much as you possibly can, but also creating a budget in which you can focus on aligning your values, the most important things that you live by. I always say the things that you would even die for, such as, you know, taking care of your health, because when people haven't had a job, they have what I call deferred maintenance, whether they haven't seen a doctor for a while or a dentist mm-hmm. for a while or an optometrist for a while. You need to spend money on yourself, rebuilding your self-confidence, making yourself more attractive, feeling great about yourself. And don't be afraid to invest in that. Notice that I didn't say spend money on that. I said invest yeah. in that. It's really important.
And what do you think about that? How does it feel to think about making those types of expenditures?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, like, I was actually thinking of cosmetic dentistry recently. I have a tooth that's been discolored and problematic since I was a child, actually. And my insurance isn't going to pay for a cosmetic dentistry, but...
Why is this tooth something that you haven't gotten fixed yet?
Well, I couldn't afford it. You know, basically, it could be $2,500 or more. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I think what, you know, we also take a look at is more of the psychic value of money. And sometimes getting a tooth fix is not just the cost of it. It's also making you feel better. You smile more. You're happier. When I do a budget for a client, not only do I take a look at where they should be spending their money on, but where should they spend their money on that they're not spending their money on? What's going to provide them also more happiness? Now, we're not talking about materialism when you're saying, you know, I want to buy an expensive car, but investing in getting your tooth fixed might change just the way you smile every single day, the way you will hang out with friends, or how you're going to be at work. Writing down a budget and then putting down also, what are the things that I would love to have in my life that I would have a regret if tomorrow were the last day on earth? What are some of the things that you would want? And then also align those with your values. What's important to you? Is family important to you? Is your health important to you? Is giving back to charity important to you? Because when you align your money with your values, there also tends to be a lot more happiness in life as well.
Do you think your tooth would be on that list?
You know, it's interesting because I have had some work on it, but it was never perfect. So, yeah, I look at pictures of myself and I noticed it. And yeah, I guess the short answer is yes.
You know, Maria, I think if you can sit down with what I call a fee-only financial planner that can actually sit down and do some goal setting and give you some numbers as to what the appropriate amount of money you need to save for retirement if you worked another 13 years or whatever.
That's good advice. I hadn't thought about seeking professional help.
Great. Maria, thank you. Thanks for writing. It's a great question, and it is so nice to have somebody whose outlook is improving.
Yeah, we're really happy for you, Maria.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And Luis, thank you. Luis Barajas is a certified financial planner here in California.
What it takes to be a budget hero? Try your hand at fixing the nation's finances and see how your choices stack up to others. Go to budgethero.org and play the popular online game from American Public Media. That's budgethero.org.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. If there's one place that we all have control issues, it's the workplace. Sometimes it feels as if we've got absolutely no control there, especially when the economy's bad and people are getting laid off. And it's bad enough in real life. Do we really want to watch workplace control issues play out on TV? Well, Fox thinks we do.
You're going to identify three employees that you believe are bringing the company down. three employees that you select will be at risk to be fired.
That's from Fox's new reality show, Does Someone Have to Go?, where coworkers vote on who's next to be out the door. Chris Abrego is the executive producer of the show and is with us now. Hey, Chris.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Is this kind of like an office Survivor? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, really. It's kind of, would say, Survivor meets The Office, if you want. That's kind of Brian Lowry from Variety kind of coined that, and I've been running with it. It's really well said. I would call it Survivor meets The Office.
Now, why make this show, and why make it now?
The show, I think, is, you know, I've always wanted to do something in the workspace. You know, something we're all fascinated with. And in terms of my entry into this space, I thought one of the most relatable things is what is the one thing everyone can relate to? And in going around my office and talking to other people, the one thing everyone related to was that most of the time in most offices, they think they know better than the boss.
And so that's what this is about, being the boss.
It really is just about that. It's not so much about where the company's at in terms of its, you know, financial place. These companies we're working with are very successful. It's really about these employees who think they know better than the boss. Therefore, the boss gives them the opportunity to show it.
And gives them the opportunity to fire their colleagues. This is not small amount of drama we're talking about.
Listen, absolutely. The show is often called sometimes the firing show. But there's a lot of other stuff going on. It does give them the authority to let someone go if they feel that's what needs to do in order to fix the office.
Now, I read the show was originally in development right around 2008 and the crisis and all these people losing work. What was the decision like to hold it and why bring it back?
I think early on the decision was we had shot a pilot in 2008 and originally it was called Someone Has to Go. It was bottom line was, listen, at the end of the day, someone's leaving. Someone's getting fired. And I think obviously where everything stood and the truth is, I think obviously with time, the economic time, the show was also focused on the economy. It was focused on companies that were needed to downsize. That's not the focus of this show anymore.
Right.
We kind of retooled it. You know, it's really about office personnel issues. It's really about the level of how, you know, the toxic level of an office sometimes. In order to fix that, sometimes does someone have to go?
And, you know, we're still in an economy where a lot of people are out of work. This is still really touchy. How did you sort of think about that?
You know, I get that question a lot in terms of, like, how can you be firing people in this
right.
economy? That's just, like, it's absolutely wrong. Well, that's not what the show is about. It really is about, think about someone who does have a job and is not doing their job. Think about somebody, for example, the first episode, we have a salesman there who's been there for 2 years and he's making his base salary. Well, what does that mean? He's not selling anything.
Yeah.
And so he's not doing his job. Think about somebody who could use that job, come in there and do a great job at it. It's not about just firing somebody simply for the sake that, hey, I don't like you. It's not a popularity contest. These employees took it serious and they evaluate each person's value to the company and then they make a decision.
So I understand that in the show you actually reveal everyone's income. How much does that factor into the decision whether or not to let somebody go?
It's pretty wild, a lot, to some extent. But I have seen people turn it around, meaning that some people, unfortunately, did get judged immediately because of the amount of money they were
right,
making.
You're just making way too much.
Like, hey, you're just making way too much for what you do.
Right.
For what you do. And in one case, we have the mother of the owner of the company mm-hmm. is the accountant, and she's the part-time accountant.
And probably makes it
And the highest paid employee.
Ooh. Yeah.
So you can imagine where that goes. But these guys, she did a great job in proving to her peers her value to the company. And you'll see that in the episode.
So what did you learn about office dynamics and surviving in the office place from filming the show?
Oh, I genuinely learned a lot. It was wild being that, you know, I myself don't have a real job and being in television.
You don't have a boss to report to?
Well, I don't work in that environment. You know, it was interesting and I did learn a lot. We did, four different offices and I learned they shared a lot of similarities. And I learned that there's a lot of that the employees have on their chest that they want to get off. They generally don't have a voice. And this, once they've been given this voice, they took it with a lot of responsibility. And they really came through on a very articulate, professional kind of level. And I think in every office, they did the right thing.
Chris Abrego is the executive producer of the new Fox reality show, Does Someone Have to Go? Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
On next week's show, we'll be talking more about thriving and surviving at work. You got questions for us? You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and online at marketplacemoney.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. We got a poll on our Facebook page where the good news is you're the boss, but the bad news is you have to fire someone. Now, we did try to make this pretty easy for you. We added Dwight Schrute from The Office to your team. You got Pete Campbell from Mad Men, Jonah from Veep, and a couple others to choose from. And it doesn't take me more than a second to figure out that I toss Pete Campbell. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch, with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Chris Clark is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yor. Special thanks this week to member station KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma. I'm Adrienne Hill. I hope you have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.